content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated May 22/May 29, 2023. Bordered in red on the front cover, an inner border of white. Time is in large block capital letters in white. That little thumbprint, not thumbprint, but a place to put your thumb to turn the page that says our 100th year is still there on the upper right corner. And at last, I have one photograph of one person on the cover of Time to describe to you. The coronation of Charles III. Finally, King. By Tina Brown, we will be going to that article shortly. It is King Charles III in all of his royal coronation regalia, seated on that ancient wooden throne chair. The crown is on his head, the bejeweled, heavily bejeweled and ermined crown sits atop Charles's head. He is holding, I think it's called the Rod of State or something like that. It's gold with more jewels on it, in his left hand. He looks somber. He looks serious, really not somber. He looks serious here as he's looking toward perhaps the congregation or audience. The robe he's wearing is a gold brocade with some interesting loops around the collar and some kind of decoration. I suppose it's embroidered. It is a design not familiar to me. One side has something that looks like gold and white blobs inside a dark elliptical area. This would be positioned on his collarbone, essentially, but it's a design on this golden robe. And the other side is something swirly and green. Moving now to the articles within this magazine. First of all, milestones. There are not many here today either. Awarded E. Jean, J-E-A-N, Carroll. $5 million in damages from Trump. This short article is written by Anisha Coley. May 9, a Manhattan jury found former President Donald Trump liable for sexually abusing and defaming writer E. Jean Carroll. The jury awarded Carroll $5 million in damages after a two-week civil trial in which she testified Trump sexually assaulted her over 25 years ago in a New York department store and then defamed her after she spoke out about it in 2019. A 79-year-old former Elle magazine columnist, Carroll is one of over 20 women who've accused Trump of sexual misconduct since the 1980s. Trump, 76, has denied all allegations. This is the first such claim that has been tried before a jury. I'm here because Donald Trump raped me, and when I wrote about it, he said it didn't happen. He lied and shattered my reputation. I'm here to try to get my life back, Carroll said in court. Carroll has said the attention she received after speaking out and Trump's insults inspired intense backlash on social media and cost her her job at Elle. The jury checked sexual abuse over rape on the verdict form. Because it was a civil case, Trump was not convicted of a crime and faces no prison time. But it follows another history-making turn for Trump, who in April became the first former president to be criminally indicted in a separate case related to allegedly falsifying business records over hush money payments to a porn star. After the verdict in the Carroll case, Trump, who is running for president again, posted on his social media platform, Truth Social, "This verdict is a disgrace, a continuation of the greatest witch hunt of all time." He said he would appeal the ruling. In her own statement, Carroll described the jury's decision as a victory for every woman who has suffered because she was not believed. The final column of the Milestones three-quarter page today includes six more headings. Failed, First Republic Bank, which was seized by regulators and sold to J.P. Morgan Chase May 1, the latest collapse in a months-long banking crisis. Charged, Representative George Santos of New York with fraud, theft, money laundering, and making false statements in a May 9 federal indictment. He pleaded not guilty. One, that's W-O-N, a copyright lawsuit by singer-songwriter Ed Sheeran, with a federal jury ruling May 2, he did not plagiarize Marvin Gaye. Surpassed, 200 mass shootings in the U.S. this year, according to the nonprofit Gun Violence Archive, during a first weekend in May that saw a gunman at a Dallas area mall kill 8 people. Arrested, Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan by paramilitary forces May 9 on corruption charges, sparking protests. Died, daytime talk show host Jerry Springer, April 27, at 79. Canadian singer-songwriter Gordon Lightfoot, whose hits included The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, May 1, at 84. Oakland Athletics fastball pitcher Vida Blue, May 6, at 73. Now to the cover story by Tina Brown, The Triumph of King Charles. This is a double-page photo in color, as was the cover photo, which I believe is an excerpt from this one. This includes not only Charles seated on this wooden throne chair, it's ancient, in his golden regalia, holding the rod of state or something like that in one hand, and another fancy ornamental symbol in his other hand, and that's partially obscured by the back of a person standing by him. Four people more or less surround him. It's King Charles III in solemnity, wearing St. Edward's crown and holding sovereign's scepters in Westminster Abbey, May 6. The other people are not identified, but they're all clergy because their vestments indicate that. One is undoubtedly Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, but it is not captioned, so I will not try to guess the identity of the others, two of whom are seen by the camera lens only from the back. After decades of waiting, the new monarch meets his moment, by Tina Brown. Tina Brown is author of The Palace Papers, Inside the House of Windsor. Another photo here of the, in color, of the great processional. Yeah, it's the coronation procession with Queen Camilla inside Westminster. These people are all processing, that is, King Charles, surrounded by clergy, followed by pages, Queen Camilla, surrounded by clergy, followed by pages and her two personal attendants, and then various personages of the royal family, clearly seen are Prince and Princess of Wales, William and Catherine. On either side of the aisle are members of the congregation or audience standing and facing the procession as they head up the aisle. Special report, as he stood in for his ailing 96-year-old mother at the opening of Parliament in May 2022, it was hard not to catch Prince Charles gazing mournfully at the imperial crown next to him on a velvet cushion. That is, the crown was on the cushion. The irresistible thought bubble his expression suggested was, "Mummy, when?" Trumpets. May 6, 2023, the 74-year-old man who spent more than five decades in the waiting room of his destiny, longer than any Prince of Wales in history, finally walked through its door. King Charles III, by the grace of God, of the still united Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and of his other realms and territory, head of the Commonwealth, defender of the faith, had placed on his head by the Most Reverend Justin Welby, Archbishop of Canterbury, the nearly 5-pound solid gold St. Edward's crown at Westminster Abbey. Crowned alongside him was the 75-year-old woman, who has herself shown years of shrewd, strategic patience, Queen Camilla. Even the baleful stare of Prince Harry, who blurted late that he would attend the ceremony but without Meghan, cannot throw shade on the former mistress's vindication. This was no off-the-rack coronation. A flurry of belabored palace bulletins in the past months about a slimmed-down, budget-conscious ceremony suggested an occasion as suffused with mixed messages as the king himself. To whittle the guest list to 2,000 from the 8,000 hanging from the rafters at his mother's coronation, the cavalcade of ermined dukes was mostly booted in favor of National Health Service and charity workers and other inclusive representatives of an effortfully modern Britain. The few MPs who made the cut did not get a plus one, a bitter pill. Princes of the blood and other grandees were not required to take the knee and swear a Shakespearean oath of fealty. And unlike Queen Elizabeth's bladder-busting 3-hour ceremony, this 2-hour 21st-century coronation was not much longer than a Premier League soccer match. Not that the king would have arrived at his coronation in the Diamond Jubilee state coach, wearing a lounge suit, nor would much daylight be let into the magic of the anointing when, like his mother 70 years before, the king donned an austere, shift-like garment off-camera and was doused from a medieval spoon with consecrated oil. Unlike at Queen Elizabeth's coronation, no civet oil or ambergris from the intestines of sperm whales was added to the formula for the sometimes vegan Charles. Then he slipped out of his sacred mufti into the gold floor-length super tunica before emerging in the pièce de résistance of the deep purple robe of estate, or imperial robe. If it all threatened to be irresistibly Monty Python, so what? The potent flummery of the monarchy still holds the British people in its thrall. It is meant to be a never-ending story, and a month since Charles's ascension have been a seamless rebrand of the House of Windsor as an institution built to survive. A recent BBC YouGov poll found 58% of Brits support the monarchy. Charles's reign began with his pitch-perfect address to the nation after Elizabeth's death. 10 days later, striding at the head of her funeral procession, bearing his field marshal's baton. He seemed to grow in stature with each metronomic step. For most of his life, Charles was tortured by his father, Prince Philip's underestimation of his gifts and the Queen's remote mothering. But in this critical moment of transition, it all fell away. On his face, you could see both the pain of losing his mother and the final shedding of his childhood's doubting burdens. The benefit of his eternal weight is that Charles has become king at a moment that uniquely speaks to his concerns. For decades, he was mocked for his jeremiads about climate change and the despoilment of the English countryside. Now, as the world self-immolates and glaciers melt, even his most merciless critics acknowledge his prescience. His people know exactly who he is, Charles the Green, a woke grandpa with a complexion pinker by the minute, who drives an Aston Martin fueled by a bioethanol blend of cheese and English white wine byproducts, and who assuaged his grief in the Queen's last hours by foraging for mushrooms in the Balmoral Woods. At a time of divisiveness and volatility, it's a kingly image that quickly is reassuring. Charles has defied every prediction of what would happen when a monarch as beloved as his mother dies. There's been no national identity crisis, certainly none attributable to him, no collapse in public appetite for monarchy, no immediate repudiation, yet, by the sovereign Commonwealth realms, and no disregarding of constitutional red lines, as some expected, to sound off about his favored causes. Yes, then Prime Minister Liz Truss put the kibosh on his attendance at the November COP27 UN Climate Change Conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, where he had planned to make a speech. But Charles immediately asserted the puissance of the crown as a political convener. His Buckingham Palace reception for world leaders on the eve of COP turned out to be the most coveted power ticket of the week, all the more effective because it stood aloof from white-hot policy debate. It is easy to forget that after decades of Dullesville, Commonwealth tours, and ceaseless FaceTime with an encyclopedia of potentates, Charles is one of the best-wired diplomats in the world. His first state visit as king to Germany in March, where he tapped his Hanoverian roots to speak in fluent German, was hailed as a flawless post-Brexit charmkrieg. The perception of Charles's progressive instincts has always been undermined by his fogey self-presentation. He must have been the only Cambridge undergraduate to wear a suit and tie in the summer of love. Some of his first acts as king have brought refreshing flair to the stodgy iconography of monarchy. The image of himself Charles selected for the nation's postage stamps to replace the crowned head of his mother is a simple one, bareheaded and unadorned. He chose Joni Ive, ex-Apple design whiz, to conceive a beautiful, optimistic coronation emblem with the four entwined flowers of the UK that reflects the king's concern for the planet. And he blessed the cool innovation of releasing digital twins of the coronation crowns using augmented reality, brainchild of Anthony Geffen, producer of the documentary The Crown Jewels, that were available on smartphones everywhere. Pausing here for a second with more photos of the royalty. Queen Camilla, apparently emerging from the abbey and about to enter the coach on the way to Buckingham Palace. It's gold. It's gold everywhere. And then Camilla in her lovely ivory coat dress with all of her diamonds and her crown, surrounded by pages, her attendants, and more royalty following. four of the pages, including Prince George. This is a pose from the balcony. They're all in their red livery with lots of gold trim. Prince William, the Prince of Wales, paying tribute to his father, who is seated not in the big clunky wooden throne chair, but in a more stylized one. And he is kissing his father on the cheek. And then an overview of part of the audience. We see at the lower left the King and Crown Princess of Sweden. More royals, including the King and Queen of Jordan. I don't recognize any of the others until I scan backwards a couple of rows. And there's Prince Harry and the daughters and sons-in-law of Prince Andrew, behind whom are seated Princess Michael of Kent, Prince Michael of Kent, and Zara Tyndall. Sir Timothy Lawrence and Anne, the Princess Royal, are seen greeting Prince Harry and others in that group. The line of succession, King Charles on the top with his former wife, Princess Diana's photo on one side and Queen Camilla's photo on the other side. Extending downward, now this is like a family tree, then from between Diana and Charles are William, Prince of Wales, first in succession, Catherine, Princess of Wales. Second, after Prince William, is Prince George. Third is Prince Charlotte. Fourth is Prince Louis. Then back up to that second row where fifth is Harry, Duke of Sussex, connected to Meghan, Duchess of Sussex. Sixth is Prince Archie, and seventh is Prince Lilibet. Small, very small thumbnail photos accompany those captions. Returning now to the text, more significantly, Charles's decision to open the Windsor Archives to aid independent research into the British monarchy's ties to slavery is nothing short of revolutionary for an institution that has usually battened down on the past. Some might see Charles's actions as a brilliant stroke of proactive public relations at a time when demands for colonial reparations are part of an ever-rising tide of aggrievement, especially among the young. But in Charles's case, his earliest speeches show his desire for deep cultural reexamination comes from an authentic place. A spokesperson for Buckingham Palace, April 6, repeated his message to Commonwealth leaders in Rwanda last year. I cannot describe the depths of my personal sorrow at the suffering of so many. As I continue to deepen my own understanding of slavery's enduring impact, the king is said to be accepting, even relaxed, about his inevitable removal as head of state in the 14 remaining Commonwealth realms. Elizabeth, too, after all, was a master at presiding gracefully over imperial retreat. But unlike his mother, Charles knows the deep sympathy she expressed in her historic 2011 trip to Ireland would never be enough to expiate some of colonialism's worst sins. The only serious migraines for Charles in the first months of his reign were caused by his own son. The firm has contained the blast radius of explosions from Harry, the human hand grenade, by following Queen Elizabeth's tested playbook. When faced with tumult, like the publication of his incendiary memoir, Spare, and the solipsistic whine of Meghan and Harry's Netflix documentary, the royal family has ramped up public appearances and done what they always do, say nothing, and smile, smile, smile. With a certain amount of backstage mirth, the palace released a statement expressing the king's disappointment that Meghan would be staying in Montecito, California with his grandchildren. Harry nonetheless managed to grab the spotlight yet again when he galloped back on his steed in late March to appear in a London courtroom for the latest round in the tabloid phone hacking cases. Revelations about what seemed to be covered-up complicity between his own family and the tabloids ensures that each brother is still ready to raise an army against the other. And what of Queen Camilla? Palace insiders believe her success is even more assured than the king's. Hers is one of the greatest image rehabs in modern history. In the 18 years since she married Charles, her performance has been so sure-footed that the woman, reviled as an old bag, old trout, prune, and hatchet face in the 90s by the tabloids for usurping the adored Princess Diana, is now on her way, at least in the now uniformly glowing press coverage, to becoming a British national treasure, the Maggie Smith of the monarchy. Camilla's loyalty, humor, and humanity, her stoic commitment, like her late mother-in-law's, to just getting on with it, has proved she understands the quintessential tenet of monarchy, how to play the long game. Vivat Rex, at a time when everything seems to be bollocksed up in Britain, sometimes spectacularly, tribal and atavistic beliefs in the monarchy, both mortal and majestic, somehow trundle on. One more photo here, half a page in color, folks seated in the front rows in Westminster Abbey at the coronation. Prince William and Princess Catherine, with Princess Charlotte and Prince Louis during the coronation ceremony. The adults berobed, bespangled with their royal garments. And the two children between them, Princess Charlotte looking cute in her white outfit, and her little brother Louis next to her pointing at something as if he's pointing towards the rafters. Maybe he's pointing toward the high altar. Maybe there were big screens there for the children to better see their grandfather being crowned. Now to the risk report by Ian Bremmer. Erdogan may face both an election and a decision. For more than 20 years, Recep Tayyip Erdogan has remade and dominated Turkey's politics. First as prime minister, then as president, he built a political foundation with support from voters outside the country's powerhouse cities, Istanbul, Ankara, Izmir, with appeals to traditional religious values and socially conservative policies. Over time, however, he's also polarized the country by amassing more and more executive power in his own hands and by silencing, in some cases imprisoning, critics and journalists who tell stories he does not like. He's sidelined judges who do not rule his way. Following a failed military coup in 2016, he purged the upper ranks of the army. Now he faces his toughest test. The largest opposition parties have united behind the candidacy of a single challenger, a technocrat named Kemal Kilicdaroglu. I'll spell that for you. Kilicdaroglu. Voting begins began May 14, and a second round runoff on May 28 appears likely between the combative and charismatic Erdogan and the mild-mannered and consensus-oriented Kilicdaroglu. Current polling says this race could go either way. Outsiders will focus on expected differences in their foreign policies. Even as a member of the NATO alliance, Erdogan has established a degree of independence between the West and Russia. At various times, he's both courted and infuriated Russia, Europe, and the U.S. with a transactional approach to nearly every important question. His ability to play one off the other is limited by Turkey's dependence for security on NATO and on Russia for a strong economy, particularly in the tourism sector. Erdogan has not joined other NATO members in full backing for Ukraine, but he has offered Turkey services as a crucial deal maker, including on the flow of both Ukrainian and Russian agricultural products out of the Black Sea and into the Mediterranean. Erdogan's harsh words for the EU and some European governments, and his foot dragging on questions like NATO membership for Finland and Sweden, has made him a gadfly in Brussels. That's the main reason a Kilik Daroglu victory would be welcomed in Europe and in Washington. His foreign policy would focus on restoring trust in Turkey's reliability as an ally for both NATO and the EU, even as he continues to approach Vladimir Putin with pragmatic caution. Kilik Daroglu would also be expected to breathe new life into Turkey's long-term bid to join the European Union. If so, EU officials would respond with warm diplomatic pleasantries, but the cost of support for Ukraine and hesitancy in Europe about Turkey's longer-term direction will encourage Brussels to slow play a return to serious accession negotiations. Yet there's a more immediate question that has the attention of observers, both inside and outside Turkey. If Kilik Daroglu wins the presidency by a razor-thin margin, might Erdogan simply reject the result? He's done it before. When his party's candidate lost the race for mayor of Istanbul in 2019, Erdogan forced Turkey's electoral court to annul the result and rerun the election. This strategy would work only if the vote is close. But the stakes for Erdogan are now much higher. This time, it's his name on a nationwide ballot. If Erdogan hesitates, it would likely be because his party then lost that rerun Istanbul mayor's race by a much bigger margin, dealing Erdogan's reputation for political invincibility a blow from which it has not fully recovered. It would still be a mistake to underestimate Erdogan's willingness to urge his supporters into the streets, and opposition demonstrators would be quick to respond, creating political upheaval. It would also be a mistake to doubt Erdogan's ability to win. His political talent and the loyalty of his supporters remain formidable. Here's the View inbox. Here's one column entitled Health Matters by Jamie Ducharme, health correspondent. Researchers have long tracked the mental health of America's teen girls. They have found that depression has become more common over the past decade. And in 2015, the suicide rate among teenage girls hit a 40-year high. More recently, data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, has shown nearly 60% of U.S. teenage girls feel sad or hopeless. And in 2021, 30% said they considered suicide in the prior year, up from 24% 2 years earlier, a new report finds. In addition, about 24% had made a suicide plan. 13% had attempted suicide. 4% required medical care related to an attempt. Among boys, those percentages were about 14%, 12%, 7%, and 2%, respectively. Suicidal thinking was more common among teens who did not identify as heterosexual. American Indian or Alaska Native girls were most at risk, but rates among Black, Hispanic, and white female students rose most dramatically. It is hard to say why these rates are increasing, since suicidal behavior rarely has one cause, but understanding why certain teenagers are more likely than others to think about, plan for, and attempt suicide may help researchers design school or community-based support programs. Noting the differing rates among teenagers of various genders, sexual orientations, and racial and ethnic backgrounds. The CDC report suggests developing interventions tailored to people of all identities. If you or someone you know may be experiencing a mental health crisis or contemplating suicide, call or text 988. I shall repeat that last sentence. If you or someone you know may be experiencing a mental health crisis or contemplating suicide, call or text 988. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. Dianne Feinstein had already made history back in 1978 when she became the first woman elected to lead the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, effectively setting the agenda for the legislative arm of the country's eighth largest economy at the time. She was in practice the Speaker of the San Francisco House, but when a former colleague turned assassin, returned to City Hall with the intent to kill four political rivals, it was Feinstein who found her colleague Harvey Milk dead. Five bullets struck America's first out gay politician, including two directly into Milk's head at point-blank range, just down the corridor from Feinstein's office. Before reaching Milk's office, the gunman had killed Mayor George Moscone, leaving a vacuum that demanded Feinstein immediately rise to become the first woman to lead San Francisco. For Feinstein, the circumstances of her promotion to mayor felt deeply unrewarding. But she would go on to win the seat on her own and serve 10 years. It was one of the string of firsts that would mark a remarkable career in politics, stretching from her first appointment in 1960 to the California Women's Parole Board till now, when she is the oldest member of the U.S. Senate, and owing to challenging health these days, its most debated figure. To say Feinstein, now 89, is facing mounting pressure to resign would be to undersell the frustration among even her biggest fans. Feinstein is fast becoming a master class in how to spoil a legacy. She's providing a stunning demonstration in how to soil an inevitable obituary with tales of missteps rather than of purpose. Rather than being MIA, she's now seen as AWOL, even by her apologists. Senator Dick Durbin, by no means a radical in his caucus, and Feinstein's successor as top Democrat on the powerful Judiciary Committee, made clear how much the narrative had shifted. The bottom line is the business of the committee and of the Senate is affected by her absence, Durbin said. Feinstein's truancy for the past almost 3 months, ostensibly to fight shingles, has left the Senate largely paralyzed, especially on the most important thing Democrats can do without the cooperation of the Republican-led House, and that is to confirm federal judges. Then May 9, her office confirmed her doctors had cleared her to return to Washington, where no doubt she would have to join blunt talks about her party's future, with or without her vote. Absent a functioning Judiciary Committee, Democrats in the Senate are largely left to chase bipartisan fever dreams and bat-back House Republican stunts. Without her vote, Democrats were stuck with a listless 10-10 tie on judiciary. Put bluntly, if she cannot be a constant presence, Feinstein could leave her Democratic colleagues wasting time in the 118th Congress, which ends in early 2025. Feinstein had long kept her plans vague, as is the right of anyone facing such a personal decision rooted in a health crisis, but her 40 million constituents also deserve representation, and absent a voting lawmaker for months, that was getting tougher and tougher to defend. Feinstein has been a remarkable force for good, if you share her grounding in Democratic politics. Her run is almost unrivaled by any of her colleagues, male or female. Yet the political pressure bearing on her now is impossible to ignore. She has been a first in so many roles, but maybe the last to realize her time away from Washington is about so much more than herself. Teach Citizenship the Way the Founders Intended, by Sal Khan, K-H-A-N, and Jeffrey Rosen, R-O-S-E-N. There's a photo here. Oh, it has no caption. Well, I'll describe it to you. It's an old-fashioned schoolroom, probably a one-room school. It has the American flag in the front corner. It has a clock on the wall. It has an old-type lamp hanging from the ceiling. It has a photograph of somebody, probably the president, at the time this school was last in session. It's indiscernible to me. It has a blackboard. It has a big desk in front of the blackboard. Facing the big desk and the blackboard are 1, 2, 3, 4 at least rows of the old-fashioned bolted-to-the-floor seats. The seats flip up, and the desk in front of them is attached to the seat in front of it, and the floor is wooden plank, and there's iron on the sides of these desks, and that's what holds them in place on the floor. There's a wainscoting halfway up from the floor to the ceiling. There's a pot-bellied fire, probably wood-burning, maybe gas-burning stove in the middle of the room. It's a one-room schoolroom. The authors, Khan and Rosen, are the respective heads of educational organizations Khan Academy and the National Constitution Center. New data released by the Department of Education, known as the nation's report card, and widely regarded as the best assessment of how well we're educating our future citizens, paints a stark and worrying picture. Eighth graders scored worse on the history section this year than in any other since the test was first administered on the subject in 1994. Civic scores dropped for the first time since it was first tested in 1998. Fewer than 1 in 4 students scored as proficient. The problem is not necessarily in the classroom. When our political leaders wage school wars over what historical models can and cannot be taught, they signal to students that certain views are simply not worth considering. When our news media promote the loudest and most antagonistic voices, students learn shouting is more effective than listening. When parents refuse to engage with arguments they disagree with, students come to believe that listening to opposing viewpoints is a sign of weakness rather than of civic strength. Small wonder, then, that according to a recent UCLA-UC Riverside study, more than two-thirds of high school principals reported substantial political conflict over hot-button issues inside their classrooms. We will endanger the American project if we fail to teach our children the principles of our democracy and the habits of civil dialogue necessary to sustaining it. Instead of building a better future by finding common ground, they will only slide deeper into partisanship and extremism. Fortunately, there's a way out, but it requires a new way of thinking about civic education. We need to teach students not just history and civics, but also the virtues of democratic citizenship, beginning with the ability to consider arguments with which we disagree, and to engage in dialogue and deliberation with people who hold views different from our own. In practice, this means giving students a rigorously nonpartisan education in American history and civics. We must expose them to the best arguments on all sides of the major constitutional debates, past and present, and give them the tools to make up their own minds. At the founding, leading framers, including George Washington and James Madison, dreamed of a national university that would bring together young Americans of different perspectives and backgrounds to teach the habits of deliberation and the core civic knowledge necessary to informed citizenship. They never built this institution, but technology makes it possible today. For example, our organizations are partnering to create a free online Constitution 101 course premised on a simple act, bringing together experts who genuinely disagree about the most important constitutional issues facing our nation today, and using their examples to model thoughtful, respectful, civil dialogue. With a faculty composed of leading conservative and liberal historians, constitutional scholars, judges, and public servants, our course will teach students America's constitutional principles using primary sources spanning U.S. history, including Supreme Court decisions and the dissents. Exposed to ideas across the ideological spectrum, students will have the content and the space to consider America's past and present from multiple perspectives and reach their own conclusions. There's already evidence that this approach works. In research conducted during a pilot phase of this new course, we found 20% of students reported an increased desire to engage in difficult conversations, both inside and outside their classrooms. As we approach America's 250th birthday in 2026, we have the opportunity to reverse our civics spiral and revitalize knowledge of the ideals rooted in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution that unite us. It will take all the adults in the room to show our young citizens that compromise and deliberation are not vestiges of their grandparents' America. The brief, Health, Five Ways to Find Humor in Everyday Life, by Angela Haupt. If you think your life's too boring to be funny, joke's on you. Humor is all around us. Cultivating more humor in your everyday life is one of the fastest and most powerful ways to increase overall health and well-being, says Stephen M. Sultanoff, a clinical psychologist and professor at Pepperdine University, who studies how people can benefit from the healing powers of humor. The experience of humor and distressing emotions cannot occupy the same psychological space, he says. Adding humor to your daily life can lead to a wide array of benefits. Research suggests it sparks energy, boosts brain power, improves immunity, curbs stress, and improves mood. Some of those benefits stem from laughter, which is the physical response to humor, Sultanoff says. But not everyone laughs when they're amused, and you do not have to in order to reap benefits. Experiencing humor also has less visible effects. It shifts thinking in healthy ways and provides new perspectives. Plus, it leads to what Sultanoff describes as relational fusion, or the social benefits derived from laughing with others. When you experience humor with somebody, you bond with them. There's this moment of connection, he says. When people are bonded, they generally feel more relaxed, safer, and more comfortable. We asked Sultanoff and other experts for their favorite ways to lighten up everyday life. 1. Figure out what makes you laugh. Comedy is like music. We're all drawn to different genres, says Kate Nichols, a New Jersey-based psychotherapist and stand-up comedian. Think about what kind of humor appeals to you the most, then seek it out as often as possible. Go to comedy shows, spend more time with people who make you laugh, put on a funny movie instead of that hard-hitting emotional drama you usually watch, Nichols says. Social media can also be useful. Create a folder on Instagram or TikTok where you save the funniest memes or videos, then return to them when you need a moment of levity. 2. Identify at least one funny thing a day. We are often oblivious to what's in front of us until we start looking for it, so set a daily intention to look for humor. When you wake up in the morning, say, I'm going to find one thing today I can giggle at or at least smile about, suggests Alan Klein, author of The Healing Power of Humor. Then see what happens. You will likely find the funny in unexpected places and laugh a lot more than usual. 3. Train yourself to be quick-witted. Sultanoff integrates humor into his psychotherapy practice in a variety of ways. He recalls a client who had taken his infant to a hair salon on a rainy day, and as he was leaving, the stylist said, "Be sure to cover up the baby," a comment that really irked him. Sultanoff issued a challenge. If the man could go back in time, what might he say? The funnier, the better. Sultanoff was delighted by what his client came up with. Don't worry about the baby. He hasn't had a shower yet today. It's an easy exercise to repeat after uncomfortable experiences. Brainstorm quips, and you'll train yourself at some point to be able to do them in the moment they occur, landing a one-liner in real time. 4. Master one joke. Many of us innately love to make others laugh, and doing so does not require great comedic skill. I tell people to learn one simple good joke, Sultanoff says. It doesn't have to be long. Practice it, then use it in situations that need some levity. 5. Enlist props. If you end up sitting next to Klein in traffic, you might notice he is wearing a bright red clown nose. The world's so serious these days, he says. I put it on and look in my rearview mirror, and it instantly lightens things up. One couple he knows puts on clown noses every time they start to argue, immediately breaking the tension. Sultanoff also encourages the use of props. After getting an x-ray, he likes to slip on glowing red thumb lights, tell the tech he's feeling strangely radiant, and then gives a thumbs up. That person has a moment of joy with me, then goes home and tells other people the story, he says. It is a highlight of my day, and hopefully theirs. While sitting here reading that column, I'm looking on the edges for something to smile about. And here it is. It's an ad. It's one column long, but the whole page in length, actually. It's from Purina for Beneful Incredibites Pate, just for small dogs. And the top says, Big Taste, just for small dogs. And here comes a little dog, a terrier-type dog, leaping at me from the photo on the page. It's mostly white, and it's got a little brown face above its nose and floppy brown ears. And I can just see it's just happy in flight. And it does make a person smile to see a happy little dog on the page. This article will be abridged for time constraints. The brief news, Nation, as police forces shrink, private security takes over, by Alana Samuels, North Philadelphia. Andre Boyer enters the gas station like a soldier, look back straight, boots shined, AR-15 pointed toward the floor. He seems unaware of the flutter of anxiety spreading through the store. But if anyone asked, which they do not, he would assure them that he is there for their own good. We're not here to beat people up, says Boyer, who heads SITE, a private protection agency that's patrolling gas stations and hotels in Philadelphia at the behest of store owners. We are here to let the public know they can feel safe. Boyer's armed guard service has boomed over the past year as Philadelphia police staffing issues led to longer response times. Neil Patel, who owns the gas station, hired Boyer in December after thieves stole an ATM and the police did not respond for 6 hours. Across the country, police departments that already were struggling to recruit new applicants saw a spike in retirements and a drop-off in new recruits after the 2020 murder of George Floyd and subsequent backlash against police, says Chuck Wexler, executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum. The number of sworn officers dropped 7% from 2019 to 2021 nationwide, according to FBI data. Meanwhile, crime was rising in many parts of America. Murders, assaults, car thefts rose nationally in 2020, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, and first responders found themselves busy confronting crises such as homelessness and opioids. These factors bolstered a private security industry that had already been growing steadily since the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. Since 2020, it has soared. Today, there are roughly twice as many security guards employed in the U.S. as there were 20 years ago. According to the Security Industry Association, though the nation's population has grown only 16% over the same time period. By 2021, there were about 2 police officers, but 3.1 security guards for every 1,000 residents. Private security is going to take over everything, says Boyer. He adds that a father recently hired him to take his 2 children to the movies, armed with a shotgun, to make sure they were safe. It is true that Patel, the gas station owner, says he has not had to report one criminal incident since hiring Boyer's firm, but then he says his store was a constant blur of crime. People were stealing and carjacking. One time his car was vandalized while police were in the store, taking down a report about another crime. He is sick of it all. I ask, couldn't an armed guard have escalated those situations and led to someone being killed? Too bad, he says. They deserve it. Then he retreated behind the bulletproof glass, shielding his cash register. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.